Morning. Today's daf and Shabbos Memtes. We're on the top of Memtes. I'm now for four lines down. The two dots. Ibailahu. The Gemara is about to ask a question. We started yesterday. The fourth parak of Shabbos. Fourth parak is dedicated to the topic of Atmana, insulation. A person under circumstances is allowed to insulate his food before Shabbos, but under most circumstances is not allowed to insulate his food neither on Shabbos nor before Shabbos as well. If the material that you're using to insulate your food is a davar hamosif hevel, if it's adding heat, so then one is prohibited to insulate that food both on Shabbos and even before Shabbos as well. The prohibition of insulating your food with a davar hamosif hevel is that if it's a material that adds heat, so then the chachamim were concerned that if you do so with a material, even though the material itself is not something which you can stoke, but then it will end up leading to using a material that you could stoke like coals. And ultimately, what's going to end up happening is that you will end up stoking the coal. So it's exerud the rabbanan shema yechate begachalim. The concern is that you're going to end up stoking the coals. If it's davar she'eino mosif hevel, if it's something which doesn't add heat, but it just simply preserves and maintains its current heat, so then that is allowed to do before Shabbos, but one is not allowed to do that on Shabbos itself. So this is the basic premise of the concept of the idea of Hatmana, and we started yesterday the fourth parak, and we started yesterday with the Mishnah. The Mishnah that then broke down for us what are materials that add heat versus what are materials that just simply maintain the heat. The Mishnah started off with describing the materials that add heat. And the Mishnah, if you go back to the beginning of the parak, yesterday's daf, really goes back to Mem Zayin Amud Beis. So the Mishnah gave us a list of Ein Tomnin Lo B'Gefzer Lo B'Zevah V'Lo B'Melech V'Lo B'Siv V'Lo B'Chol. The Mishnah rattles off five materials that are going to be adding heat. And these five materials, they're the residue of the olives and manure and salt and lime and sand. So they're going to be considered a davar hamosif hevel, whether they're in the state of being moist or being dry. The Mishnah then goes on to rattle off another list, lo b'tevim, lo b'zagim, v'lo b'muchin, v'lo b'asavin, a list of four items. But they're only going to be a davar hamosif hevel only when they're moist, but not when they're dry. These items are the residue of the grape press. Let me go in the order of the Mishnah. Straw, residue of the grape press. Muchin, as we're going to be discussing extensively today, is some sort of soft material. Yesterday I described it like cotton. It doesn't have to be cotton. It could be any soft material. And asavim is grass. So these materials are only going to be considered davar hamosif hevel only when they're moist. With that introduction, we go straight to our Gemara. We're on the very top of Mem Testament Aleph. And the Gemara asks the following question. In order to qualify as a moist item, the Mishnah obviously here is asking about the latter four of the Mishnah. So in order for them to be a moist item, does the moisture have to be internally generated? Or can the moisture even come from some sort of external source? And Rashi over here points out, Rashi is the third line down, Lachim Achmas Asmam, Mechamamus Tfei, Melachim Achmas Mashkin Shinofel Malei Mishi Yavshu. So Rashi writes over here that we're assuming that if we're talking about internal moisture, so internal moisture creates more heat, it becomes a more potent item, rather than the moisture that comes externally, meaning the item dried out, and then you rehydrated the item. So the assumption, says Rashi, in the Gemara, is that that's not going to be as much heat. So when we say that these items have to have moisture, are we talking about the internal moisture? Are we talking about even moisture that comes from the outside? Tashma, the Gemara comes and brings the proof in the following. So we're quoting over here the list of items that can only be a davar hamosif hevel only when they are moist. And included in this list is muchin. Now we said muchin is anything soft. We're going to assume right now, that the description of muchin over here is a reference to the wool that comes off of a sheep. And the Gemara is assuming right now that I'm sorry. And with that assumption, the Gemara now goes like this: Iyamart bishlam alachim achmas davar achir shapir. The Gemara says, now the wool that comes off the sheep, so I understand if we're talking about the hydration that comes externally. The Gemara says, but if we're talking about where the moisture is internal, it's internally generated, So for many of these items that are listed over here, so you understand how they have some sort of internal moisture. Let's take Zagin, for example. Zagin is the residue after the grapes are pressed. So you understand how the grapes had liquid in them, and it's very possible that this residue is moist, and the moisture is internally generated. That makes a lot of sense. But if we're talking about the wool that comes off of the sheep, we assume generally that the wool is coming off bone dry. And the only way that it can get dehydrated is only externally. And what kind of wool are we talking about where we just sheared it off the sheep, and what kind of wool has its internal moisture? So the Gemara says, if that's the question, it's not absolutely solid. Mimarta debeni amte. So the Gemara says, look, there are certain areas of the animal, of the sheep, where when you pluck off the wool, it will have internal moisture. Let's say, for example, it sounds disgusting, but let's say the armpits of the sheep, right? So there is a lot of perspiration, there's a lot of sweat, and so when you pluck off that section, so that is going to be that is going to have internal moisture. V'hadini Rabbi Yoshia, the Gemara continues. The Gemara says, "Tomnim b'ksus b'yevashu v'peres yevashin, avalo b'ksus lacha v'lo b'peres lacha." Okay, we have another brisa describing hatmana using. You can do hatmana with clothing that's dry and with fruit that's dry, avalo b'ksus lacha v'lo b'peres lachin. But you can't use wet clothing and you can't use wet fruit. So ksus lacha machmas atzmeichem mishkachala. It's basically the same question. Well, if I have clothing, what kind of internal moisture are we talking about within the clothing? The moisture that is in a clothing must be externally based. So the Gemara says, Mimarta debeni atme. And the Gemara gives the same answer as well. We're talking about clothing that was just made from wool that was plucked off from the sweaty areas of the sheep. And so it's definitely a dochek. We're forcing an answer into the braisa because we're creating this ukimta that we're talking about specifically where we're talking about the wool that comes from the armpits of the sheep, where there it has internal moisture. So admittedly, a bit of a forced answer, but the Gemara says, but it could be that that's what the Bryce is talking about, and so therefore no conclusion in terms of whether or not the moisture is internally generated or the moisture can even come from an external source. We're at the Mishnah, Mem Tesamad Aleph, Tomnim B'Ksus V'Peres Kanfeyona Uv'Nesor Shal Charashim Uv'Ne'or Shal Pishtan. This Mishnah now tells us what is something that is not a Davar HaMosif Hevel, and therefore you're allowed to do Hatmana. And let's emphasize that we're talking about before Shabbos. So you could do Hatmana using clothing and fruit, Kanfei Yonah, the wings of a dove, Uv'Nesor Shal Charashim. You could use the sawdust of the carpenter, Una'or Shal Pishtan. And you could use the fine product that the flax seed gives. So there's basically some, when you comb out the flax, so there's this fine, it's almost like a flour that comes out of it, and so that you could use in order to do hatmana, because these are items that only preserve the heat, but don't add to the heat. And the Mishnah says, shal pishtan daka. It's very fine. It's a little bit strange, because the word na'or is by definition is talking about the fine particles that come out of the flax. Rabbi Yehuda oser bedako mati begasa. Rabbi Yehuda says that to use the fine stuff is prohibited, but if you're going to use some of the coarser stuff, it's going to be permitted. Now, it's not clear which material Rabbi Yehuda is commenting on, and the Gemara is going to see clarity on that issue, so we're going to get to that in just a moment. Here we are in the Gemara in Mem Testament Aleph, and we are about to go through one of the more famous stories that is told throughout Shas. Am Rabbi Yana Tzilin Tzrichim Gufnaki, that when you put on your tefillin, you must have a clean body. The Gemara in just a moment is going to define what that means to have a clean body. Ke'elisha bal kanafayim. Just like Elisha, who had a particular nickname, he was known as the owner of the wings. Now we'll see exactly how it is that he got his nickname. The Gemara is actually going to tell us a story that yields the nickname. So Maihi. But the Gemara first goes back to this idea that tefillin needs to have a gufnaki. It is fair at this point to wonder, what does this have anything to do with our Mishnah? I'm going to address that question after we get to the end of the story. So, Maihi, what does it mean to have a gufnaki? Abaye amar shalo yafiach bahem, Rabba amar shalo yishan bahem. So, Abaye says that one is not allowed to pass gas while wearing tefillin. Rabba says that one is not allowed to sleep while wearing tefillin. Now, it could be that they're not arguing. Could be that they agree with each other. in terms of what exactly are the parameters of having a guf naki while wearing tefillin. Now, Rashi says, Shelo yisham behem. So Rashi writes over here, what's the problem with sleeping with your tefillin on? So Rashi says, Shema yafiach. So it's interesting. Rashi really coalesces the two positions. Rashi says that if you sleep, so you end up passing gas. And that's the... and so basically it comes out now that Abai and Rav are essentially saying the same thing. Rashi also adds, O Yira Keri. Rashi says that you may also have a seminal discharge while having slept, and that also is not a guf naki, and the tefillin demand to have a guf naki. Tosus over here objects to Rashi in terms of being a Baal Keri. You can see Tosus, Divra Masko, Shalo Yishan Bahem. Tosus also adds that perhaps the issue is Hesach Hadas, meaning the way Tosus describes it is that when you're sleeping, so you're not being conscious and conscientious of your tefillin, and it's a lack of mindfulness of your tefillin. That according to Rava, you have to be aware of your tefillin while they're on. That is obviously a higher threshold than just simply not passing gas. Either way, we are now going back to the Gemara and we're describing Elisha Bala Kanafayim, and we say that he had a guf naki. Now, it wasn't clear in the Gemara how we know that he had a guf naki. So Tosfos writes over here, Tosfos, you can see Divra Amasko Elisha Bala Kanafayim. I'll just say it outside. Tosfos says that we're going to see that something miraculous occurred with him, and so therefore we assume, says Tosfos, that the only reason why he merited to have a miracle is because he had such a guf naki. He was so careful about cleanliness while wearing his tefillin. That's the that's Tosus's premise. So anyway, Shaloish, I'm sorry. We're back to the Gemara. Va'amaykar ele bal kanafayim. So the Gemara now wants to know why. How is it that he got such a nickname? Shavamachas gzera machas romi arisha gzera al yisrael. Because at one point historically the Romans made a decree against the Jewish people. I mean, many points they made a decree. But the Gemara now is highlighting one time. Shekol aminiach tefillin inakru es mochol. Anyone who puts on tefillin is going to have his skull punctured in. And Vehaya Elisha Manicham V'yotzei l'shuk. And Elisha decided that despite the fact that the Romans made such a decree, he put his tefillin on and he went out to the market. Ra'u Kazdor Echad, a Roman official sees him. Ratz Mipanav. Now Elisha makes a run, running away. V'ratz Acharav. The Roman official runs after Elisha. The Kevin Shi Higia Etzlo Nat Lamirosh V'Achsam Yado. Now, as the Roman official draws closer, so Elisha takes the tefillin off and cups them in his hands in order to hide them from the Roman official. Amalo Mazeh Biyadecha. He says, what do you have in your hand? Amalo Kanfei Yona. He says, I have the wings of a dove. Pasha Des Yadov Imse Kanfei Yona. He opens up his hands and he sees that, in fact, he has the wings of a dove. Leficha Karnoso Elisha Vakanafayim. And as a result of that, he got the nickname from that point going forward as Elisha Baal Kanafayim. Umayshna Kanfayona, Mishar Ofos. Now, why did he say that he had Kanfayona? Of all the birds, why is it that he equated, he compared the tefillin that he had in his hands to Kanfayona? Mishum de Amto Knesset Yisrael Yona, because we have an idea that the Jewish people are compared to Amtils from the word Mashal. They're compared to a Yona. Shenemar Kanfayona Nechbe Bekesef, the Pasuk in Tehillim, describing the kanfei yona, the wings of the dove, contextually, it's a reference to Klal Yisrael. So ma yona kanafem meginas alah, Yisrael mitzvos meginas alah. And when it comes to the yona, so the wings of the yona is that which gives the affords protection for the yona. So too, when it comes to the Jewish people, our wings are going to be our mitzvos. They're the ones who serve and protect us. How exactly do the wings protect? So I'm not going to go through it right now, but you can see Tosos, where he quotes the Medrash in terms of the nature of the Yonah and how exactly its wings protect it. But anyway, the Gemara now has concluded with the story. Now, it's so interesting that of all the follow-up questions that the Gemara asked after having told over the story of Elisha Bala Kanafayim, the only question that the Gemara is wondering is why is it that he said that he had in his hands, instead of tefillin, he had the wings of a dove. That was the only follow-up question. There are obviously many follow-up questions that we can ask regarding the story of Elisha Bala Kanafayim. But the two principal questions that I'm just going to deal with are, number one, why is it that the Romans made a decree that if one were to wear tefillin, one would be killed, And Elisha went out despite that into the marketplace, tells us the Gemara, in order to put on his tefillin in defiance of the Roman decree. And it clearly indicates that he's ready to give up his life in order to put on his tefillin. Now, if you're ready to give up your life, so that requires a threshold. Meaning, generally speaking, we are required to preserve our life. The Gemara says, v'chai bahem, that we are to live by the mitzvahs of the Torah, we're not to die by the mitzvahs of the Torah. So the general assumption, the starting point is that we're not supposed to give up our life. And there are circumstances where we are supposed to give up our life. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet is the principal location in Shas where the Gemara discusses exactly what you're supposed to give up your life for. We know the Gimel Chamuras, there are three stringent averas that one is supposed to give up his life for. Shvichas Dami, murder. Gilui Arayis, sexually illicit relations. And Avodah Zarah, idolatry. There are also times when a person is supposed to give up his life, and that's Gzeiras Malchus, if there was some sort of governmental decree against the Jewish religion, or if it's Farhesia, or if it's public. And so, going back now to our Gemara over here, so why did he put on his tefillin in defiance of the Roman decree? So presumably the answer you're going to give is because it's Gzeiras Malchus. Okay. If that's true, so and that's not the only way to say it. There are other ways to say it, but if that's true, so then it begs only the next question. And that is that when he saw the Roman official, so he quickly ran and ultimately removed his tefillin and lied about what he had in the contents of his hands. So if he felt that he was justified and correct in doing the act of Kiddush Hashem, so why didn't he go through with it? Now, I'm not asking the question as a challenge to his character, God forbid. I'm just simply saying that from a halachic standpoint, if he really felt that he was involved in the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, so then why did he change his mind and said, you know what, I'm not interested in Kiddush Hashem. Now, the simplest answer could be the human condition, human nature, meaning he thought he was in a position where he could do so, and then he discovered that he wasn't. But from the halachic perspective, from the halachic mind, you want to try to give some sort of halachic principles in terms of why it is that he put it on and why it is that he took it off. Both of these questions are extraordinarily difficult questions. They do result in a lengthy discussion. And I'm not going to go through some of the sources now, but there is a lot of source material on these two issues. And so this is not a small topic. This is an extraordinarily big topic. We, however, are going to go on in the Gemara, but I want to just raise the basic issues as we see the daf. B'nisar Shacharashim, we're going back now to the Mishnah, and we're talking about the items that are not Mosif Hevel. And now in the Mishnah listed off items that are not Mosif Hevel, and then the Mishnah quoted the position of Rabbi Yehuda, where he says that if it's a fine material that you can't use, but if it's a coarser material that you're allowed to use. Now, when Rabbi Yehuda was making distinction between fine versus coarse, was he talking about the carpenter sawdust? Was he talking about the particles of the flax? So Tashma Detanya, the Gemara says, we have a brisa. Rabbi Yehuda Amar, Na'arishal Pishtan, Daka Harei Kazeva. That if you have the Na'arishal Pishtan, the fine flax, the fine particles that come off the flax, so that is like Zevel, it's like fertilizer. Go back to the previous Mishnah. Fertilizer is the davar mosif hevel. Clearly, he's commenting on the fine flax. Shema minah, na'arishal pishtan, kai shema minah. So the Gemara says, okay, good. So we can conclude now that we have a crisper understanding of the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda. His objection was only to the fine flax. Tomnim bishlachim. We are at the Mishnah on the bottom of Mem Tesem and Aleph. And now we're talking about other materials that you're allowed to do Hatmana, meaning that these materials are a davar she'eino mosif hevel. One is allowed to do Hatmana bishlachim. Shlachim are basically the hides that come off of an animal, leather hides. The mitaltalin also. And one is allowed to move them on Shabbos. Now, we already made this point yesterday. Let's reiterate. The items that I use for Hatmana for installation don't necessarily have to be non-muksa items. You can use an item that's muksa for Hatmana. Now, that's a little bit strange, but as we already pointed out yesterday, you're not allowed to move muksa, but you're allowed to get benefit from muksa. So the items that are muksa, which are now serving as installation for your pot, so you can't move them, but you can certainly get benefit from them. So over here by the shlachim, by the animal hides, so you can move them, I'm sorry, you can do Hatmana with them, and you can move them, meaning they're non-muksa items. Now, if the installation is a muksa item, so how exactly are you going to be able to open up your pot, take it out of the installation, if the installation is muksa? It's a good question. In fact, the Mishnah in just a moment is going to address this very question. Now, you can use the tufts of wool. However, the tufts of wool are muksa. So you could use them for the installation. Again, just to review, because you're allowed to benefit from muksa. You can use them for the installation, but they are muksa. And so now the Mishnah wonders out loud, well, if that's true, Kate said who owes it. So then what are you going to do? Meaning that if you want to take your pot out of the installation, and the installation is muksa, so what do you do? So no tells the kisu veheno flows. So what the Mishnah says is as follows. We're assuming right now that the installation is insulating the entire pot on all sides, on the entire exterior of the pot, including the top of the pot. And so now you have these tufts of wool, which are muksa, which are sitting on the top of the pot. And what you're going to do, says the Tanakam, is you're just simply going to take off the lid, vehein no flos, and the muksa is going to fall off on the side. And this is what we call in halacha tiltul min atzad. You're moving the muksa, but you're moving so in an indirect manner. And as we already saw earlier, and now we get to review again, it is a point of controversy whether you can do this tiltul min atzad. Clearly, our Mishnah is of the position that you can. And so therefore, you're going to be removing the lid so that the muksa falls off to the side. And the Tanakhama says that would be just fine. Let's ask a really simple, straightforward question. And that is that if we could just envision this pot going into Shabbos, so we have the pot and there's insulation all around the exterior of the pot of this muksa item. In this case, we're talking about the tufts of wool. It's on the bottom of the pot, it's on the sides of the pot, it's on the top of the pot. And now let's just envision going into Shabbos that basically the lid is now supporting, holding the wool that's above it. And we have learned in the end of the third perek this idea of a basis ledavar ha'asar, that if something serves as a base for something which for that is prohibited, so that itself becomes muksa as well. This is the principle of basis, which we already discussed back in the previous perek. Now over here, can we not make the following argument? That the lid is serving as a basis for the tufts of wool that are directly over it, and so therefore the lid itself should be muksa as well. Okay, that's a good question. Now this question is addressed by Rashi himself. Rashi says, "Noto kisui." Rashi dibra amaschal noto kisui shel kedera sheish toros kli aleha. So you simply lift off the lid, says Rashi. Which, and of course, the lid has a shame kli. It's a utensil. It's not muksa. The afagav shehin aleha lo ichpatlan. Rashi is addressing our question. Now it's true that the wool is above the lid, and the lid was holding and supporting the wool. But Rashi says, in this particular regard, we don't care. Delo nasis basis lahen shein asui ela lixos kedera, because you have to look in terms of basis, in terms of functionality. What is serving what? As far as putting the wool on top of the lid, I'm going to reread the Rashi. Lo nasis basis, it does not become a basis shein asui ela lixos kedera, because the only reason why you're putting the wool on the lid is only to cover the lid. So in other words, the wool is serving the pot. If the wool is serving the pot, you can't then say that the lid of the pot now is a basis. A basis is only when the item underneath is serving the item on top of it. But in this particular regard, when the item on top is serving the lid, so therefore we do not give it the label, the definition of being a basis. That's Rashi's explanation in terms of why we do not use the principle of basis over here to consider the lid to be muksa. Back to the Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Amar Kofa, Kupa, Mata al Tzidah v'notel, Shema Yitol v'eino yochel lahachzer. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah has a different maneuver in terms of removing the pot from the installation. And basically, and the Gemara is going to discuss this in more detail tomorrow's daf, really. And that is that according to Rabbi Elazar, if I just simply were to remove the pot from the installation, so now you have a vacuum, and what's going to happen is that the installation on the side is now just simply going to go into the center. And in order for you to put the pot back in, you're going to have to move it back to the side. And that's going to require you to directly move the muksa. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says that what you're going to do is that you're going to tilt it to the side, and then after tilting it to the side, then you're going to remove the pot. So it still gives you an area in which if you want to return the pot, you can do so. The Chachamim say no to a Machzer. And the Chachamim say no, you just take the pot out and you put it back in again. Now, why isn't the Chachamim concerned about this issue, about the collapse of the installation, and you may end up moving the installation? So again, let's wait till tomorrow. The Gemara is going to discuss this in much greater detail. We're starting with the Gemara Yosef, Rabbi Yonasan ben Achinai, Rabbi Yonasan ben Elazar, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Chanina bar Chama Gabayu. We frequently see this kind of construct in the Gemara, where the Gemara describes a sitting of Amorayim. But clearly the Gemara over here is highlighting one of the Amorayim, because the Gemara says you have these two Rabbi Yonasan sitting together, and Rabbi Chanina was with them. So clearly in just a moment the spotlight is going to go on Rabbi Chanina bar Chama. V'kami bailuhu, and they ask the following question, Shlachim shel balabayis. That when I have the hides of, V'kami bailuhu, and they ask the following question, Shlachim shel balabayis tanan, aval sh'uman kem et kapit alai lo metaltalin luhu, odil mo sh'uman tanan v'kol sh'ken shel balabayis. And the question that's presented is the following. In our Mishnah, the Mishnah is very clear that the hides of an animal are not muksa. Now they're not muksa, why? So they must have some sort of utility. I should have said this back in the Mishnah, but okay, but at least I have the opportunity right now. They have utility. What's the utility of an animal hide? So assuming that it is not foul-smelling, and in a moment we'll discuss whether or not it was tanned or it was not tanned, but basically when you have the hide of an animal, you could use it as any kind of seat cushion. You could put it down and you could sit on it, and it's got some sort of utility, it's got sort of function, and therefore it is not muksa. The Gemara's question now is as follows. When the Mishnah was talking about the hides of an animal, are we talking about hides of an animal that are owned by a balabas, owned by just a regular layman? Are we even talking about the hides that are commercially owned, that are owned by some sort of business? What would be the difference? And the difference is that if you have a hide that's owned by a business, so that is obviously hides that are for sale. As a result of that, so it could very well be that the owner of the business would not be appreciative of the fact that someone just simply now borrowed the hide, right? Some sort of business partner were to borrow the hide and just sit on it. What are you doing? What are you doing with our product? Meaning that's something that we're going to sell. That's not something you should be sitting on. And we could say, although the Gemara does not say this, we could file this under Muksa Machmas Chisaron Kis. Meaning we don't want people to use it right now because to us, the value of the item is only for its sale and not for its current usage. And so therefore what the Gemara is entertaining is the idea that the hides that are owned by a business that are meant for sale are going to be muksa, and I'm suggesting, although it's not clear in the Gemara, that the muksa over here is muksa machmas chisaron kis. Good. That's the Gemara's question. Amalu Rabbi Chanina bar Chama, kach amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yossi. So now Rabbi Chanina is giving the answer, because again, the spotlight's on him, and clearly the Gemara now is highlighting him, because he's the one that's going to provide the answer. Kach amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yossi, we now turn to the top of the Amud Beis. Abba Shlach Ahava, my father was a tanner. V'amr heviu shlachim neshev aleihem. And often would he say, while in the warehouse, he would say, you know what? Just bring me those leather hides over there. We need to sit down on them. We're going to sit down on them right now. Interesting Rashi over here. One word Rashi. Interesting Rashi. Rashi says that he was describing his practice during the week. Right? Rashi writes v'amr b'chol. Now, from Rashi's standpoint, isn't the whole point over here is that you would use them even on Shabbos as well? So what you would say for Rashi is, yeah, 100%. But right now we're just talking about whether or not the owner of the business would bother him if he would take the product and sit on the product. And even though this occurred during the week, but you see from here that generally speaking, these tanners are not bothered by the fact that we're going to temporarily use our leather hides even though they are for sale. You can see the top Tosfos over here on the Amud where he says that we're talking about on Shabbos, where this event occurred, where the story occurred. Okay, but either way. So you see over here that the hides, even that of the mocher, even that of the seller, is considered a non-muksa item. Meis for the Gemara challenges Nesom Shel Balabais, Metaltal Nesom Vishal Uman, Ein Metaltal Nesom, V'im Chishev Laseis Aleim, Pasal Orchin, Ben Kachu Ben Kach Metaltalin. So the Braisa over here talks about beams, wooden beams. And if they're owned by a balabais, which means that it's the end user, so then the beams do have value, and therefore you're allowed to move, they have utility, and you're allowed to move them on Shabbos, they're not muksa. But if they're owned by a mocher, by a seller, by an uman, where he's planning on selling the beams, so then because he's not going to make usage out of them, so then they are muksa items. Unless before Shabbos, he clearly articulated and stated that he's going to put on them bread for the guests. Meaning, if he clearly articulates that he's going to make usage of them, then they're non-muksa. But the default is that they're going to be muksa because these beams and boards are for sale. And so the Gemara basically says, you see clearly over here in this Braisa that we're making a distinction between boards that are owned by the Balabas versus boards that are owned by the carpenter, by the manufacturer. So Shani Nesarim de Kapit Alai. So the Gemara says, you can't really compare. Generally speaking, when it comes to boards, when they are for sale, so the seller really wants them to remain in a pristine state. And any kind of usage of them would really significantly devalue them. And so therefore, he will not allow anyone to make usage of them. But when it comes to the hides, as we just saw the story, so even the seller is not going to be that bothered if, before it's sold, it's used a couple of times by any person that's in the business. Okay, so the Gemara makes such a distinction. Tashma, the Gemara quotes another braisa. Aros, bein avunim, shein avunim, mutar l'talkal b'shabbos. When it comes to the hides, it does not matter if the hides were tanned or even if they weren't tanned. But as long as they have utility, so mutar l'talkal b'shabbos, so they are non-muksa items, you can move them on Shabbos. Lo amru avudim ela le'inyin tuma bavad. Now, the only time that avudim makes a distinction in halacha is only by tuma tahara. We know that by tuma, a kli is only going to be mekabel tuma only when it's a finished product, only when it has gone through a processing and it's a finished product. So vis-a-vis tuma tahara, so the tanning process is significant. But when it comes to the designation of muksa, so we see clearly over here that when it comes to the hides, these hides over here, even if they are non-tanned, but as long as they have usage and utility, so then they are a non-muksa item on Shabbos. My love, shal balabais, v'loshna shal uman. So the Gemara now, after bringing the Braisa, it doesn't seem from the Braisa that there's any type of distinction between the hides that are owned by the balabas versus that owned by the craftsman. The Gemara says, look, the Gemara deflects, and not necessarily, shal balabais. So the Gemara says, no, the Braisa is only talking about the hides that are owned by the balabas. So the Gemara says, really? So then you're telling me that if it's owned by a craftsman, so then it's muksa. So then the Braisa would try to make a distinction between hides which are tanned and hides which are not tanned. If the Braisa wanted to make a distinction, the Braisa could have made a better distinction, a sharper distinction. When is it true that you are allowed to move the hides? That's only if it's owned by the balabas. But if it belongs to the craftsman, you're not allowed to move it because it's muksa. And I'm suggesting maksa machmas chisaron kis. So why did if this were true, the Braisa should have made this distinction, and this distinction would be better because even before we have to get to separating between hides that are tan versus hides that are not tan, we can make even a more basic distinction of hides that are owned by the balabas versus hides that are owned by the craftsman. So the Gemara says, "Lo, kulu b'balabais kamari." So the Gemara says, "No, it happens to be that the Braisa is just talking about the hides of a balabais. In other words, the Braisa was never discussing the hides that are owned by craftsmen, and that's why the Braisa didn't make such a distinction." Okay, so from the Braisa, we argued in either direction. From the Braisa, we don't have any conclusion whether or not a distinction should be drawn between the hides of the balabas versus the hides of a craftsman. Tanai, the Gemara points out that this issue that we just deliberated is actually subject to a machlokas Tanai. Arisha balabais metalton osan v'shal umanei metalton osan. That when I have the hides of the balabas, so you're allowed to move them. If it belongs to an uman, a craftsman, you're not allowed to move them. Again, the distinction is predicated on that the hides of a craftsman are designed for sale, not for usage, and therefore it's muksa. Rabbi Yossi Omer, echazev echazev metalton osan. Rabbi Yossi says that you're allowed to be metalto, both if owned by the balabas and if owned by the craftsman. So this issue, which we just deliberated, happens to also be a machlokas Tanai. We're in the middle of Mem Tesa Medbeis at the two dots. Hadu Yasvi Vekamei Bailahu. The Gemara now says that there was another question. Meaning, remember, we had an assembly of three Amoraim, and we highlighted that Rabbi Chanina bar Chama is the one who's going to be providing the chidushim of that particular get-together. And the following question was asked, Hadina Navos Malachos Arbaim Chasar Achas. So we're going to learn together in the seventh parak of our Masechta, coming up not so long from now. Well, okay, sometime. Ayin Dalet. Ayin Gimel, sorry. So we're going to learn that the 39 Malachas. Now, 39 Malachas, this obviously is one of the most basic and fundamental premises of Shabbos, that there is something called a Malacha, and there are 39 of them. And if one were to violate any one of the 39 Malachas, he'd be violating Isser Shabbos Min HaTorah. Now, this idea that there are 39 Malachas Kenegin Mi. So where do we get this idea that there are 39 Malachas? What actually defines itself as a Malacha? Now, what the Gemara is asking over here is a most basic question. This is going to be the ABCs of Shabbos. Where are the 39 Malachas generated from? Now, it happens to be that this is such a basic question, you would expect the Gemara to ask this on day one of the Masechta. But for those who have been involved in the Daf long enough, you'll know, we all know, that's not how the Gemara operates. Even though we're discussing basic issues, nevertheless, the issue is not going to be discussed until we are well into the Masechta. In fact, we're about a third of the way through the Masechta. And now the Gemara decides to raise this as an issue, but that's the Derech HaGemara, that's just simply how these things work. And by the way, we'll also add, it's not even discussed in the Mishnayos, because that's not the function and purpose of the Mishnayos. The Mishnayos are not giving us reasons and causes. The Mishnayos are there to just simply broadcast information. And then it's the Gemara's job to give us a little better understanding of what's going on. So here the Amoraim are discussing, why is it that we have 39 Malachas? So Amalu Rabbi Chanina bar Chama. So Rabbi Chanina bar Chama answers, Keneged Avodos HaMishkan. So he says, well, these are the 39 activities that were necessary in terms of the preparation of the Mishkan. And so any act that's involved in the preparation of the Mishkan is going to define itself as a Malacha. That is his response. Now, although we all know this, meaning if you were to ask anyone before the daf today, why is it that a malacha defines itself as a malacha? Oh, because these are the activities that are involved in constructing and assembling the Mishkan. So we all would have known that. But as Tosfos over here points out, third Tosfos down, Arbaim Avos Malachos Chasar Achas Keneged Mi. Tosfos points out over here, Harbe Malachos Yeshu Damin La Dade. The truth of the matter is, says Tosfos, is that there are many malachas that have really, really small distinctions one from the other. And we're going to see that in terms of malachos, and the Gemara is going to ask this question later on. There basically are, a number of malachos are mimics of another malacha. Many of the malachos could just simply be truncated into what malacha? The Tosfos says, I'll give you an example. Hainu zara, hainu bora, hainu merake. We're going to be talking about separation of good from the bad. There are three malachas that cover this topic. The malach of Zorah, Borah, and Merakit. And later we'll go and we'll describe them in much greater detail. Umishum chiluk mu'at shebeinayim, Tosfos writes. And just because of a very fine distinction that exists between them, lo av mechalkin lehu, ilav de kimlu de lamates malachas hein, keneged shum davar lekach bay keneged mi. And we wouldn't have then separated them into separate malachos. Meaning we need a source to teach us first that there are 39 malachos, so then we'll know that we're going to have to take these malachos, which are almost a hair's breadth difference between one and the other, and we're going to have to separate them into other malachos. Tosfos says that's really part and parcel of what's behind the question of the Gemara. Although, to be frank and honest, after the Gemara gave its first answer, that these are the activities that are involved in the Mishkan, it doesn't really answer the question the way Tosfos sets it up. Because, okay, whatever defines itself as an activity to build and construct the Mishkan. How do I know that there are 39 activities? So even as Tosfos sets up the question, the Gemara's first answer doesn't really get us to the number 39. Okay. Amalu Rabbi Yonasan Rabbi Lazar, Kach Amar Rabbi Shimon Rabbi Yossi Ben Lakunya. Back to the Gemara. And the Gemara now is going to be giving a second answer to this question of why it is, how do we know that there are 39 malachos? Keneged malacha, malachto, malacha shebetara, arbaim chasar achas. Because if you look in the Torah and you look at the number of times that it says either the word malacha or Melachto, or Melaches, you're going to see that it says it a total of 39 times. And that is how we know that it says that there are 39 Melachos for Shabbos. This answer, the Gemara itself is going to discuss in detail in just a moment, but between us, it is going to be a difficult answer. Now that we have a database searches, so you can simply open up a Chumash, type in the words Malacha, Malachto, and Malaches, and you're going to find that the total number of times that's written in the Torah exceeds the number 39. And this is not, and we're not asking a modern question, we just simply have modern tools that really gets us to the question much quicker. This question already was posed much earlier. And so it is discussed amongst the Mefarshim how exactly the Gemara got to the number 39. And what you're going to have to say, the answer obviously is very involved because it's a very technical question, but it's a really good one. But the answer is going to, part of the answer has to involve itself with the question of when the word Malacha comes up in the Torah contextually. And so we're only counting a certain number in order to get to 39. It's not just simply a word count of all the times these words occur in the Torah. Okay, but I'm not really providing a full answer. I'm just highlighting really the problem. Sorry, I'm more about problems than solutions today. But anyway, by Rav Yosef. So now the Gemara is going to challenge the following. So the Gemara is assuming that there are 39 times in the Torah where the Torah says the word Malacha. Now, even the Gemara itself knows it's more than 39. But the Gemara is going to work with the number 40. And again, just being candid with all of us, it's really more than 40. But the Gemara right now is assuming that the number is 40. So, by Rav Yosef, v'yavo abaisa la'asos malachto mimenyanahu olo. So, Rav Yosef says, look, we have now in Bereishis, in Parshas Vayeshev, that Yosef is going to go home in order to do his work. He is now already sold into Mitzrayim. He's working in the house of Potiphar, and he's heading back to the house, la'asos malachto. So is that part of the count? Is not part of the count. So Amalei Abaye, v'leisi sefer Torah v'limnei. So Abaye says, so let's bring a sefer Torah, and let's just simply count. Meaning if the issue is whether it is towards the count or not, so let's just count. Milo amar rabba barbachan amar rav yochan lozoz misham ashe yaviyo sefer Torah. The Gemara over here is making reference to the Gemara in Kiddushin, where they had a question of what's the middle pasuk of the Torah, what's the middle word of the Torah, and the Gemara, the Amoraim themselves weren't sure, and the Gemara says, well, let's just bring a sefer Torah and let's count. Now it happens to be that Gemara in Kiddushin over there says that in finding the center letter of the Torah, it's not going to work out because we don't have bekius, we don't have expertise in terms of knowing which words are male, which words are chaser. Anyway, okay. The point is over here is that for a word count, we can just simply open up a Sefer Torah and we can count the words. Amrele, kamasafka li mishum diksiv, v'amlach aisai dayam. So he clarifies this question. We have another pasuk in the Torah that the malacha was sufficient. So is that miminyanahu? And is that part of the count? Meaning, here's what the Gemara is assuming, that there's a total number in the Torah of 40 malachas in the Torah, and obviously to get the 39 malachas, one of these two that we just cited, the pasuk in Parshas Vayeshev, Vayavo, Abaisa Lasos Malachto, the pasuk in Parshas in Sefer Shmos, Vahamalach Aitza Dayam, so one of these are going to have to be left out. So the Gemara now toggles between these two psukim, which one of these two are going to be left out. Vahakamanda Amri Lasos Rachav Nechnas. Why is it that I would take the one regarding Yosef and exclude that one? Because the word malacha over there is just a euphemism, meaning that when Yosef was going back home, he was planning on being with Eishes Potiphar. Now we all know this, or Rashi brings this down in Chumash, Rashi brings it up right here in our daf as well, that he really was almost caved into his temptation with Eishes Potiphar, and then when he walked in, so then he saw Duke Noshal Aviv, he saw in the image of his father, which prevented him from doing so. But in the context now of looking at the word Malachto, Malachto is a euphemism. So if that's true, so then it's not towards the count. And so that gets us to the 39. Odilmar, the other possibility is Vayavo, Baisalasos Malachto, Miminyanuhu. So, or the other possibility is that no, that the way to understand the word Malacha by Yosef is not a euphemism, In other words, he went home in order to just simply do work. And it was not meant euphemistically. So the word malacha over there is used in the context of malacha in its literal definition. And so therefore that should count towards the 39. And now we're going to go to the other pasuk, v'hai ha-malacha isa dayam. And as far as that pasuk is concerned, hachi kamar desham le'avidate. And it could just simply mean that the word malacha over there should be understood in the context of the work is completed. But it doesn't mean malacha in terms of actual work. It just simply is a description of that's the building of the Mishnah in its conclusion. Take what the Gemara leaves this question unresolved. So the Gemara assumes that there are a total of 40 malachas in the Torah. And obviously one of these two that we just cited is going to be not counted towards in order to arrive at 39. And now it's just a question of which of these two is not to be counted. And that's going to be based on how we're going to define each of these psukim. We have now asked a really fundamental question in terms of how we got to the number 39 malachas. The first answer is that whatever was an activity in the construction of the Mishkan is going to be counted as one of the 39. The second answer is, based on the fact that the word malacha is used in the Torah 39 times. Tanya kaman damar keneged avodas haMishkan d'tanya. The Gemara now quotes a Braisa, and this Braisa is clearly going to favor the first answer as opposed to the second answer. The Braisa reads, in chayav en ela malacha shechayotze v'aitza b'mishkan. One person is only going to be chayav on a malacha where its activity was involved in the construction of the Mishkan. Heim zaru v'atem lo sizru. They had a plant. You were therefore not allowed to plant. Now, the obvious question is, they planted in order to build the Mishkan? They were in the desert. Where exactly did they plant? Sorry for not having an answer readily available, but heim katsru v'atem lo sizru. They harvested. You're not allowed to harvest. Heim halu es akrashim mikarkala agala. They had to lift the beams up from the ground to the wagon. The wagon is assumed to be a Rishus HaYachid. We're going to be discussing this in detail later in the Mesechta, in terms of the wagons and how to view the wagons. That will be the 11th Perek of Shabbos, Perek HaZorek. So they had to transport, move an item from Rishus HaRabim to Rishus HaYachid. V'atem lo sachnisu, Rishus HaRabim to Rishus HaYachid. So therefore, we're not allowed to model that activity on Shabbos. We cannot transfer from Rishus HaRabim to Rishus HaYachid. Hey, Moritus HaKrashim Agal Alakarka. They took the beams down from the wagon, Rishus HaYachid, to the ground, which is Rishus HaRabim. Atem lo sotiyam, Rishus HaYachid, Rishus HaRabim. You are not allowed to transfer from Rishus HaYachid to Rishus HaRabim. Hey, Motziyam Agal Alagala. They had to transfer from one wagon to another. Atem lo sotiyam, Rishus HaYachid, Rishus HaYachid. And therefore, we're not allowed to move an item from one Rishus HaYachid to another. Rishus HaYachid, Rishus HaYachid, Mike Avid. The Gemara says, wait one second. What's wrong with that last one? So, Abai V'Rav, Darmi Tavayu, V'Temer of Adar B'Ava, Rishus HaYachid, Rishus HaYachid, Derech Rishus HaRabim. And again, we're going to see this in the 11th Perek. We're talking about the Malach of Hoshata, passing an item from one Rishus HaYachid to another Rishus HaYachid through a Rishus HaRabim. Perhaps the most unpopular of all the versions of Hotza'a, this action of Hoshata, we'll describe it later, but the Gemara says that's what the Braisa was making reference to. Good, and that Braisa clearly supporting the idea that the Malachas of Shabbos are all generated and platformed based on whatever is a Malach in terms of the construction of the Mishkan. Multiple times this morning I said that the definition of a Malach is that which is involved in the construction of the Mishkan. I am following the viewpoint of Rashi. Rashi here, and Rashi later on will say it really clearly, that the activities of the Mishkan are the activities involved in constructing the Mishkan. There are other opinions that say, Rabbi Hanano, I believe, right now off the top of my head, I don't know where it is, but I have it in my head, Rabbi Hanano. But there are others who say that it is the activities that are involved in the operation of the Mishkan. And there may be subtle differences between the two viewpoints, but I'll just follow like Rashi when I say the construction of the Mishkan. Okay, so let's quickly recap our morning. On the Amud Aleph, we went on to describe the materials that only are Mosif Hevel, only when they're moist. The Gemara's question of, are we talking about internal moisture? Are we talking about even moisture that comes from the outside? The Mishnah talked about which materials you can use for Hatzvana because they're only maintaining the heat, but they're not adding the heat. And as long as the Mishnah brought up the Kanfei Yona, the doves of the wing, which are there to maintain the heat but are not going to be adding to the heat. So then the Mishnah used that as an opportunity to tell us the story of Elisha Baal Kanafayim. Right, one of the most popular stories throughout Shas, where he runs away with his tefillin, the Roman catches up with him, Good. And we only raised the very, very basic issues in terms of trying to understand the story. Nisar Shal Harashim, in the Amud Aleph, Rabbi Yehuda's descent to the position of the Tanakhama, what exactly, he said the fine is non-usable because it's most of Hevel, only the coarser, and the Gemara clarified that he was talking about the particles that come off of the flaxseed. The Mishnah on the bottom of the Amud Aleph taught us that you're allowed to use leather hides, they're not most of Hevel, and you're allowed to use Gizei Tzemer, tufts of wool. They're also not going to be most of Hevel. And the Gemara had an extensive discussion on the bottom of the Amud Aleph and the top of the Amud Beis, whether or not the leather hides, which are clearly non-muksa items, so is that the ones that are owned by the balabas, or is that even the ones that are owned by the craftsman who is looking to sell them? And are they going to fall under the category of muksa, machmas, klisar, and kis? And the Gemara debated that issue, and it ended off as a debate, where Rav Yossi says that they're not muksa, even when they're owned by the craftsman, and the Tanakhama says that they are muksa. Tosus on the top of the Amud, I didn't point this out, but I'll point it out now. Tosos clearly sides with the Shita of Rabbi Yossi. And then the last thing we discussed today was where the 39 malachas come from. How do we know that there are 39 malachas? And the way Tosos understands the Gemara's question is that had it not been for the fact that we start with the number 39, we would have compressed the malachas into many fewer than 39. Because there are so many malachas that are really just a hairbreadth difference from one from the other, and we would have just simply compressed it into one category. The idea that we have to expand it to 39, where does it come from? So the first answer of the Gemara is that it comes from whatever was an activity that was used to build the Mishkan. That is going to define as an activity regarding the Malachas of Shabbos. The second answer is the word count of the Torah. It says the word Malacha 39 different times in the Torah. The Gemara spent some time with the second answer in that there's 40, and as we pointed out together, there really is more than 40, but the Gemara assumes that there's a cap of 40, and it's just a question of the 40, which one gets taken out. Gemara spent some time discussing that. The Gemara quotes the Braisa that really supports the first answer, that it really comes from whatever activities were involved in the construction of the Mishkan. Ad Kan.